From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, we reviewed the obstacles that are keeping journalists from covering the war in Iraq. This week, we consider one alternate source of information, the soldiers themselves. With computers, wireless connections, and digital cameras, soldiers are armed with everything it takes to publish a blog. Those blogs, and there are dozens and dozens of them, are bringing war in all its glory, horror, and mundanity to our home computers whenever we want to log on.
One such blog is called MaduseGunners.blogspot.com, written by Corporal Michael Bautista, based in Kirkuk in the Kurdish north. He's a machine gunner with the 116th Brigade Combat Team in the Army National Guard. When we reached him by cell phone, he told us it began simply as a way to keep in touch.
You know, I started the blog because I felt bad that I didn't write enough letters and emails to my family. And they can see what I'm doing. They can hear some of my experiences. I immediately was recognized by some other bloggers. They linked to me, encouraged me, and it's now become a hobby that I really enjoy. I enjoy the feedback. I get a lot of people that tell me that I write well. I guess I'm kind of a budding writer.
Have you gotten any resistance from your commanding officer?
I've got the tacit approval of my platoon leader. He's reviewed what I've written thus far, and I think their main concern is operational security, and I, at this juncture, have not given away any information that could be used against us or anything that would compromise my fellow soldiers. So other than that, I don't comment on Army policy. I try not to comment on politics. As long as I stay away from operational security or governmental policy, then I think I can write about what I'd like to.
Was there some principal idea that you wanted to get out there into the world through your blog that you felt needed to be expressed? Or was it just a desire to convey your personal experience?
It kind of transformed itself from a desire to convey my personal experience into letting people know the real story. I think the main coverage that you'll see at home is this car bomb blew up, this amount of people died. I think my main effort now is more towards showing that this is a good thing that we've done, regardless of what political decisions were made to get us here. We're here. We have done a good thing. I want to say to the American public that my brothers and sisters in arms that have been here before and have not come home, that have died in this conflict, have not died in vain. This is a just cause, and that it's a righteous endeavor. That's part of why I write. If I'm given an opportunity to say it, by God, I will.
What about your personal feelings? Do you ever, for instance, get afraid? And do you write about that fear?
There are elements of fear in my everyday job. But, you know, one thing is I'm sure that my enemy probably reads my blog. One of the things that I need to make sure is that I don't tell him that I'm scared of him. I don't allow them to know that they hold the edge of fear over me. I mean, hey, every day I go out into a foreign city where there are a number of people who don't want me there, and they possess explosives and guns, and of course there's fear, of course there's a little bit of trepidation every time you leave the wire, and even just walking around inside the wire. You cannot communicate that to your enemy, or else you will lose.
That was Corporal Michael Bautista, a machine gunner based in Kirkuk. Joe Schinelli, a reporter for the Army Times, has been covering the soldier bloggers. He says the Defense Department has no special rules for these newly minted correspondents in uniform.
The rules that apply to bloggers right now are the same rules that apply to any soldier who wants to write home or email home, or even if they're back in the United States and they want to write a letter to somebody explaining their training. They can't give away certain things such as unit sizes, unit locations, some specific tactics, plans of operation.
Since the Pentagon has no explicit policy covering content, it's left to individual commanders to call it as they see it on the ground.
Now, the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that speech undermining command authority is not protected under the First Amendment. Not saying that soldiers don't have protection under the First Amendment, just that it's been ruled that it can be limited if the commander is protecting the morale or welfare or good order and discipline of his unit.
So, lacking clear guidelines, Schinelli says soldiers have to decide for themselves what to share with the world and what to hold back.
One particular blogger who, he goes by the handle Greyhawk, and he recommended that anyone blogging, when they write, to write assuming that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is going to read your blog, and to apply common sense, which is obviously a huge gray area.
That gray area turned downright murky for one soldier. Jason Hartley's blog, JustAnotherSoldier.com, raised the ire of his commander and cost Hartley a demotion and a hefty fine. Just Another Soldier is frequently profane, uproarious, vulgar, searing, and poignant, but always nakedly honest. He writes about life and loose bowels and self-abuse and death. Kind of how Holden Caulfield might write if he loved the Army as much as Hartley says he does. Hartley is back from Iraq and in New York now, though he remains in the National Guard. We asked him to read a brief segment from an entry about his mixed feelings when he wrapped duct tape around the eyes of a prisoner who repeatedly refused to wear his blindfold.
There's a darkly intoxicating aspect to this kind of thing. I'm overarmed with my rifle and grenade launcher and the veritable ammunition dump that is my vest over my body armor. Because of this, my power over these men is near absolute, especially if I were to consider spending life in Fort Leavenworth immaterial. I can see how the bully feels, how one could grow fond of this darkly amusing massive imbalance of power.
You've written that it is impossible to determine when something you write crosses a line from not a violation to a violation. What do you mean?
When I got in trouble officially toward the end of our deployment, the primary thing they targeted with what I had done wrong was violating operational security. So once I finally got legal counsel, I asked them, okay, I violated operational security. Can you please – what's the legal definition of having violated OPSEC? And there wasn't one. They couldn't tell me, here's the rule you broke. Everyone listed different things that they felt were violations of operational security. There was no like golden standard for what I had done wrong as far as violating OPSEC.
You have advised other would-be soldier bloggers to retain legal counsel before they start. How come?
When this punishment came down, these accusations came down from my leadership, I felt as though I was flapping in the wind. I had no idea what my rights were. I had no idea what was realistic, what wasn't realistic. I mean, I was accused of violating the Geneva Convention, for crying out loud.
Because you had pictures of the detainees on your site.
Yeah, a picture of a person with flex cuffs on is technically a detainee and therefore could be construed as propaganda, which
you're not supposed to humiliate the captured prisoners.
Which I completely agree with. But I didn't know that. So it would have been nice if there was someone I could have gone to have explained to me, you know, what this all meant.
And you got into some famous hot water with your commanding officer. Can you briefly describe what happened?
I had been caught once in the beginning. We were at Fort Drum. We had not left for Iraq yet, and my commander found the blog. He demanded that I take it down. I relented. I took the blog down. 2 months before we were to return to the States, I put the blog back online. I went on leave for 2 weeks. I came back, and when I came back, everyone already knew about it, and I was immediately escorted to my commander, and the whole process began of me being given an Article 15. And Article 15 is a non-judicial form of punishment where basically you're given a punishment and that's the end of it. There's no jury. There's no legal process. It's a way of immediately punishing a soldier.
And what happened to you?
Once I was convicted of the Article 15, I was demoted to specialist, which is E4, and I lost $1,000 in pay. So,
are you sorry you put it back up?
No.
You were accused at one point of conduct unbecoming a non-commissioned officer because
yes.
You took a picture of yourself sitting on the can.
Yes.
Are there any posts that you regret?
I don't regret anything that I wrote. There are a few things that I wrote that I suppose I'm a bit uncomfortable with because if for no other reason for fear of how much trouble it might get me in. But that's a part of the reason why I wrote what I did is I figured it would be of interest to people who want to know what it's like to be a soldier in combat, that the more honest that I could be with how I felt, the more value it would be to a person reading it. So I would write about everything.
You wrote, "The only way for a soldier to not get into trouble is to write nothing but insipidly agreeable and conspicuously patriotic content that is reviewed by his or her leadership before posting." So yes, I do feel as though my First Amendment rights were violated.
Yes, there are a lot of soldiers who have kept blogs. There are soldiers who keep blogs now. Not all of these blogs have been taken down. Coincidentally, the blogs that remain up are the ones, in my humble opinion, that are very insipid. I mean, the Judge Advocate General for the brigade that I was a part of, he keeps a blog. It's still up. But he writes about putting up Christmas lights and we gave clothes to these cute kids today, et cetera, et cetera. There's nothing offensive about it. No one's going to harp on him for violating OPSEC because they like it.
You said that you think Army leadership can't grasp that it's possible for a soldier to be critical or satirical of the Army and still be pro-Army.
This bothers me a lot. I love the Army. I love my country. I'm very proud of my service.
And you've served for 14 years?
I've been in the National Guard for 14 years. And my commander, he assumes that I don't like the Army. It's not the case. I love the Army, and my way of exalting it is like, here's some pretty absurd stuff we did today. It's what happened. Doesn't mean I love the Army any less. It's just something kind of funny we did.
Did you learn anything about yourself writing about yourself?
Yes. I didn't really intend to always write about duality, but that was always what I found was this common thread for the most part when I wrote, was an event would take place, and there would always be these incredibly opposing ideas. Even with things that I felt sometimes, there was one time when we had an engagement, the first time that I actually shot at someone with the intent to kill them. Intellectually, I know this is morally repugnant. There's no more bigger than the murder of another human being. But that experience, that was the most exhilarating thing that I've ever experienced in my life, was making a concerted effort to kill someone. I have to admit this. I don't want to hurt people, but that was really exciting.
Would you have had to admit it if you hadn't made yourself obliged to write about it?
I suppose I would have anyways, except now there's just simply more people hearing my thoughts.
Did you kill that person?
No.
Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Hartley's blog is justanothersoldier.com. His book, called Just Another Soldier, will be out this fall.
Coming up, the Christian right has its own mainstream media. Also, reporters put the gloves on in Italy and the UK.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Capitol Hill this week, a legislative showdown with potentially far-reaching consequences drew closer by the day. At issue, 10 highly controversial nominees to the federal bench, who Republicans seemed ready to confirm by any means necessary, including changing Senate rules to prevent filibustering by Democrats. The rhetoric on both sides has been heated, but perhaps nowhere hotter than it was last Sunday when several Christian groups staged a telecast that was broadcast nationwide. It was called Justice Sunday, Stopping the Filibuster Against People of Faith, and it featured such luminaries of the religious right as James Dobson of Focus on the Family, here lashing out at Supreme Court justices.
Euthanasia is on their list of things to deal with. And pornography, unchecked and unlimited, on and on it goes, plus this matter of judicial tyranny to people of faith, and that has to stop.
The event attracted wide coverage in the mainstream press, mostly focused on the participation of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, and most of that unmistakably critical. But to Jeff Charlotte, who writes about the intersection of religion and media for TheRevealer.org, it amounted to much ado about nothing terribly unusual.
I think Justice Sunday got very overplayed by a secular media, which has been casting about since the election for a means with which to talk about the religious right. And they've been trying out different approaches. And finally, here comes this event, which gives them a very clean and precise narrative. It's almost like a political convention. You can talk about how many people this reaches and what the reception was. And you don't have to do the hard work of going out into the churches, into the small groups, which are the building blocks of the religious right, and reading over an extended period of time the media that they have built completely independent of that. And there you find that Justice Sunday is just another blip on a very broad spectrum of conversation that the religious right is having with most of America. Congressmen and senators have been coming to their churches and courting them for years. And when I go to big mega churches, oftentimes there might be a video testimonial from a senator or a congressman.
Bill Frist, Senator Frist, was criticized for using the phrase people of faith to describe those who support the president's nominees and I guess the great godless everybody else as being Democrats. How did it play with the faithful?
I think it's a little too soon to say how it played with the faithful, but this language is out there now, people of faith. Even in an article that seems to be critical of that formulation, it's now become the designated way of talking about the religious right. I think it was brilliant as media strategy. So these people who see this as a salvo in the spiritual war, maybe even one that they don't approve, nonetheless, when what they perceive as the godless liberal elite hits back, they have no choice but to align themselves with someone like James Dobson. Even when they think he is expressing a sort of an absurd message or overstating the case, he's family. He's family in a way that the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN are not.
Let's talk about James Dobson. He's founder of a Christian group called Focus on the Family. Tell me his history.
James Dobson began as a psychologist. He created Focus on the Family in Pasadena, California, originally. Moved it to Colorado Springs in the early 90s, which is sort of the capital of Christian fundamentalism. And it did so because there was such a concentration of Christian media groups gathering there and was able to acquire access to radio stations or outright ownership of radio stations around the world, such that he claims to be heard on more radio stations than any other radio host. And he claims to reach about 200 million people worldwide. I mean, in Christian America, James Dobson is as regular a source for news as is Peter Jennings.
On the question of how to support the president's nominees for judgeship, there seems to be something less than unanimity, even in the religious right. Dobson and Bill Frist themselves don't necessarily see eye to eye. Was there any evidence of this schism on the broadcast itself?
No, I don't think so. And I think that schism is something that the secular press is paying much too much attention to at the expense of the actual tidal wave of strength and emotion that is building on the Christian right. Remember, the Christian right is not monolithic. They pride themselves on the debates they hold within the movement. And that's something the secular press likes to ignore. They sort of want to look at this as a voting block. It's not a voting block. It is a social movement with different ideas. And they're all going in the same direction. I think Justice Sunday did mark the crossing of a line in terms of Frist openly talking about Democrats in the language which the religious right has until this point pretty much reserved for gay people, to say that they are an enemy. That's an expansion from just talking about liberals. And I think they now have the media power to bully the secular media to respect those terms or use those terms. And they also have the media power, as Justice Sunday demonstrated, to get that message out, even if the secular media doesn't want to carry it. They don't need the secular media anymore. And I think that's a lot of what Justice Sunday was pointing to.
Is it fair to say, then, that what was a movement has now officially, with Justice Sunday, become a crusade?
That's a good question. When do we call it a crusade? Yes, I think so. And I think so because if you go to the religious press, even the sort of the moderate evangelical press like Christianity Today, which is sort of the flagship magazine of the movement, Christianity Today has begun using the language of spiritual war, much more so than it has. And you can almost chart the growth of spiritual war as a metaphor in the religious right now. As an idea, it goes back to the beginning of Christianity. But at certain times, the metaphor kind of grows concrete, and people start talking in very literal terms of spiritual war. Spiritual war is being fought in Iraq. And if you look at the religious publishing houses, they're churning out books talking about the war in Iraq, definitely as a crusade. And there's also language that is sort of out ahead of James Dobson and Bill Frist. If you go to churches and you talk to regular people, a lot of people in the religious right are talking about civil war. And they're talking about civil war in not a metaphorical sense, in a literal sense. They hope it won't happen, but they are afraid that it might. And I think that has come through this growing metaphor of spiritual war.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Jeff Charlotte is editor of TheRevealer.org, a daily review of religion in the press, and author of Soldiers of Christ, an article in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Time once again to elect the highest official in the land. England. In his bid for re-election, Prime Minister Tony Blair is facing many of the same criticisms George Bush faced: Iraq, the economy, immigration, and education. But the similarities pretty much stop there. Among the most obvious differences is the approach of the British press. The kind of deference afforded to the president here by the media is notably absent in the UK. Listen to a recent interview of Tony Blair by Jeremy Paxman of the BBC.
Can you tell us how many failed asylum seekers there are in this country?
No, I can't be sure.
Can you give us a rough idea of how many there may be?
There's point in speculating on that. What I do know is...
Is it tens of thousands? Hundreds of thousands? Millions?
I've said I don't think there's any point in speculating.
But you have no idea.
Well, it's not a question of having no idea.
Well, what is your idea, Prime Minister?
What you can say is...
Joining me now to talk about political confrontation British style is Michael Goldfarb, WBUR's man in London. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
All three candidates, Labour, Tory, and Liberal Democrat, got the same tough and skeptical treatment from Jeremy Paxman in consecutive half hours. And I noticed the sun still came up the next day in England. Is this sort of thing business as usual in British politics and journalism?
Well, you know, it has become business as usual. But during the heyday of Margaret Thatcher, she was highly selective about to whom she would submit at election times. And people were much more deferential to her. But, you know, Blair will take on all comers, whether it's Jeremy Paxman, who once interviewing Henry Kissinger live on BBC Radio said, "Dr. Kissinger, didn't you feel a fraud when you went to accept your Nobel Peace Prize?" I mean, Paxo is famous for this. So I think people actually expect this kind of grilling. And certainly Blair has been used to it for quite a while.
Blair, as all prime ministers, are also routinely subjected to cross-examination bordering on inquisition in the well of the House of Commons, question time it's called. Do you think that practice gives the media license to be a bit pugnacious themselves?
There's a unique historical situation in Britain at the moment. The Labour Party has an extraordinary majority in the House of Commons. It's about 160-plus seats. And that effectively neutralizes the opposition. And the press now sees itself as having the role of being the unofficial opposition to the Labour Party. And so in the last few years, the press has been incredibly aggressive in terms of pursuing Blair, particularly on the way in which Britain went to war in Iraq. The press has lost any sense of deference.
And what about the public? I mean, is there any evidence, Michael, that all of this directness makes the public less vulnerable to political spin and more engaged in the political process?
They're certainly not more engaged. I think that apathy is going to be a large story in this upcoming election. I think that people now have reached that stage where they all lie, and the press lies too.
Well, Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Michael Goldfarb is a senior reporter in Britain for WBUR.
Silvio Berlusconi has been Italy's prime minister for the past 4 years. He's also the man who owns and controls 90% of Italy's television stations and a major publishing house, plus national papers and magazines. For the most part, Italians and Italian journalists have quietly put up with this near-media monopoly until now. As Megan Williams reports from Rome, the political tide may be turning for Silvio Berlusconi, and it seems this time TV isn't keeping him afloat.
Silvio Berlusconi's political and media power is extravagant by any measure, but it hasn't been enough for Italy's billionaire prime minister himself. When journalists bring to light unpleasant facts, such as his association with the mafia, charges against him for bribing judges, and his tailor-made laws to get him and friends off the legal hook, he doesn't like it.
The cover page of The Economist on 28th of April was, "Why Silvio Berlusconi is unfit to lead Italy." It made him extremely unhappy, and he sued.
David Lane is the man who wrote that article. It chronicled many of Berlusconi's shady dealings. 4 years later, he's still involved in the lawsuit against the magazine for publishing it. Lane says Italy's leader is an egomaniac with no concept of the importance of a critical press to a healthy democracy. What makes Berlusconi worse, says Lane, is his belief that he's the victim of a political witch hunt.
He's always maintained that the foreign press is in league with the center-left opposition. And despite the fact that The Economist is a notoriously right-wing magazine, he seems to believe that we, in common with other newspapers and magazines from outside Italy, are out to get him.
In his first appearance as prime minister on the public network that he now controls, LaRai, he says the plot against him doesn't stop with left-wingers and the foreign press. It includes, well, almost everyone.
Con noi questa sera il presidente del Consiglio Silvio Berlusconi. Buonasera, benvenuto.
Allora io affermo senza tema di poter essere smentito che in Italia c'è uno stato palese.
I've always contended that there is the official state and then a parallel state made up of powerful segments of society that are in the hands of the left. They include high schools, universities, newspapers, radios, television, judges, the constitutional court. And I'll stop here simply to be charitable to my homeland. Some Italians understand this, but the rest need to see this too.
Berlusconi goes even further. He says that with the exception of one newscaster, Emilio Fede, a notorious Berlusconi cheerleader, his TV stations are unpartisan.
Il fatto di essere proprietario di una televisione non comporta nulla per quanto riguarda la dialettica elettorale.
The fact that I'm an owner of a TV has no bearing on electoral politics. In fact, the journalists who work for my TV stations aren't biased, with the exception of Saint Emilio Fede, who's been a hero on a desert island and who at least offers some balance to the three terrible state-run stations that do nothing but ferociously attack their political opponents. And let me just say one thing. On TV channels that I and my family own, there has never been partisan reporting. Never, 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 never. There's never been attacks on my political rivals.
It's an amazing lie, because Berlusconi last year had fired from the public television, from the RAI, important Italian journalists as Michele Santoro, as Enzo Biagi.
Media commentator Tommaso De Benedetti says Berlusconi's favorite method of silencing critics is by firing them. But he's also turned to the courts to put a chill on political debate here.
I think that Berlusconi is an international anomaly.
Giovanni Valentini is one of the journalists being sued by Berlusconi for an article on Berlusconi in advertising, where he pointed out the prime minister's conflict of interest in pocketing more than $3 million from TV ads a year.
Don't forget that he is the strongest political man in the Europe. 1,000 times more rich than the American president.
Valentini writes for La Repubblica, one of the few dailies that has dared to speak out against Berlusconi. One of the reasons? It's owned by Carlo De Benedetti, who once tried to buy the second largest publishing house in Italy, Mondadori. Instead, says David Lane, Berlusconi took control of it through bribing judges. But newspapers themselves aren't that influential. The two main papers, openly critical of Italy's leader, La Repubblica and L'Unità, have a combined circulation of less than 800,000. The real power lies in television.
Tutti dicono un fiore.
Berlusconi's three privately owned channels are renowned for combining fluffy entertainment with fawning political talk shows. This lightweight fun and games combo, says Giovanni Valentini, has been key to swaying a lot of voters.
And we know that about 6% of the electors votes under the television influence. This 6% is about 3 million people. And in the last political elections, we have about 600,000 of votes, difference between center-left and center-right. This is the problem.
A problem, yes, but perhaps not as big as critics have feared. Italy held regional elections across the country earlier this month, and the dissatisfaction with Berlusconi and his government was resounding. In 11 of 13 regions, candidates from opposition parties swept into power. With national elections a year away, voters have shown they're no longer so amenable to Berlusconi's self-serving laws and poor handling of the economy. And, says media critic Tommaso De Benedetti, this time, even surprise appearances on TV aren't helping.
Berlusconi now is overexposed, and the credibility of Mr. Berlusconi is really, really weak.
But it's not just a question of overexposure. As Giovanni Valentini says, promotion only works if the product is good.
But when the product is not good, is bad, television is not enough.
And at last, it seems, Italians just may be ready to change the channel. For On the Media, this is Megan Williams in Rome.
Hi.
Coming up, the Gray Lady's first public editor looks back on his life and times, and the best coverage of genocide you'll never see.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Melville Charitable Trust Foundation, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Just before 9 o'clock Thursday evening, CBS News anchor Bob Schieffer offered a typical post-news conference wrap-up of the president's remarks on Iraq, North Korea, education, and especially Social Security.
The president came on television tonight because he wanted to talk about Social Security, and I think it's fair to say he did not step on his own story. I think there was no bigger headline than what he said about urging these reforms in Social Security tonight. So that is our CBS News coverage of the president.
A reasonable summary, except that it wasn't a post-news conference wrap-up. It was a mid-news conference wrap-up. The event was still in progress when CBS, NBC, and Fox deemed it necessary to break away for critical developments in Survivor, The Apprentice, and The Simple Life with Paris Hilton. The networks had already prevailed on the White House to move up the start time to 8 p.m., lest too much precious sweeps period inventory be sullied by trivial questions about torture of terror suspects, nuclear-tipped Korean missiles, and partial privatization of the retirement safety net. Even President Bush seemed nervous when he realized he had overstayed his welcome.
Free Korean Peninsula. Final question, Hutch. I don't want to cut into some of these TV shows that are getting ready to air. For the sake of the economy.
Then at 9:10, he left too, maybe to catch a little Survivor before bedtime. But don't be too disgusted with the sacrifice of reality at the altar of reality television. The news conference was showbiz too. A vain and bizarrely deferential press corps, not so much being journalists as playing once on TV, briefly punctuating the president's 70-minute political commercial. Sort of Survivor Washington, rigged so that nobody gets voted off the island.
For years, the New York Times resisted calls to hire an ombudsman. Then in October 2003, after an internal review triggered by the Jason Blair scandal, the paper reversed its stance. Editor Bill Keller appointed longtime magazine journalist and editor Daniel Okrent to the new post of public editor or ombudsman. Okrent agreed to take the job for 18 months only, and since then, he has written a lively and widely discussed column investigating reader complaints. Last Sunday, nearing the end of his tenure, he took on what he rightly calls the hottest button, how the Times covers Israel and Palestine. I wondered, was he saving this particular topic for last?
Oh, absolutely, for a variety of reasons, good reasons and bad reasons. The bad reason, I was going to lose a big hunk of my readership whenever I wrote it. I feel that it's an issue of such toxicity and volatility that there would be people who would say that, you know, I can't read this guy anymore, he's so wrong. The good reason, the one that was not simply to preserve my readership, was that you really have to be careful, and you have to study something like this over time. And I wanted to give it as much time as I possibly could to read the coverage on a daily basis, to make it through the daily emails, and report from the most considered position I could reach.
Could you summarize what position you took in that column?
Primarily that I don't believe that there is any active bias. I think that there are reasons why the Times does journalism that displeases people and that is in many ways inadequate that have to do with the nature of daily journalism. The Times is unable, and no newspaper is able, to include enough history in a given article to explain why something has happened. We can say there was an attack on this Hamas leader's house because last week there was a bombing in Jerusalem, and then the week before that there was this which caused the bombing in Jerusalem, but you can't take it back to
5,000 years.
Yeah, which is really what you would need to do.
But as you say, that's one of the problems of daily journalism.
Yeah, daily journalism, as I said in the piece, is it's absolutely essential and it's wholly inadequate for a story like this one.
You make the very good point in the column that just because everybody says you're wrong doesn't necessarily mean you're right.
That's a fairly common defense that journalists use. Well, they're screaming at me from both sides, so I must be doing something right. And, you know, in a different context, I wrote that that's like saying that a man with one foot on a block of ice and one foot on hot coals is comfortable. It just doesn't work that way.
What was the reaction?
The reaction was instantaneous, and it was loud, and it was large. Through the first 2 days, which is the usual measurement I use, I had received 600 emails specifically about the column. And surprisingly, about 150 of them, maybe a little bit less than that, were very positive, supported the position that I took. About a similar number said I was horrible and they would never read me again. And the other half were mixed. Yeah, this is a good point, but you failed to mention this. And I rarely get a positive response to what I write because, you know, you don't go to the complaint department because your shirt fits. You come to me because you don't like something in the Times or you don't like something that I've written specifically. So I was really gratified and surprised.
Now, what about your overall effectiveness, let's say, in your job over the past 18 months? I know that you told Bill Keller, the editor of the Times, when you took it, that you wanted only 18 months on this job. You wanted there to be a period at the end of your sentence so that no one would think, inside or outside the company, that you had a stake in the New York Times.
Yeah, I think that was very important. It's amazing how much freedom and authority you have if you're a lame duck. And I think it has been essential to my being able to do the job well. I really do.
And so what did readers tell you? What did writers there and editors there tell you? Were they glad you were there or not so much?
You know, they were glad I was there, except for those people who were not glad that I was here. If I were doing their job, I would find somebody like me probably very irritating.
Well, let's state your humility as read here. And tell me where you think you've been the most effective.
Oh, geez. I want to claim humility even if it's false humility. I'd rather, you know, you ask other people where they think I've been effective. There are two things that I'm particularly pleased about. One is I am told that on Monday mornings after I write, people come in and discuss what I wrote. They argue about it. They disagree with it. They say Okrent doesn't know what he's talking about, but they're engaged by the issues. And if that is indeed the fact, then I've made a real contribution because these are issues that journalists should think about regularly, but like everybody in any job, you begin to run on autopilot and you stop thinking about them unless you're forced to. My other contribution is I was the experiment. I was the canary in the mine. I survived, and the job is now on its brink of becoming permanent and not just an experiment. So I think that if my doing the job the way that I did made it possible for the Times to always have a public editor, then that's great.
Part of your raison d'etre there was to serve as a sounding board for readers. Did they regard you that way? Did they feel that there was more of a give and take because you were there?
I think so. I have found it exceedingly gratifying, those times when I will get an email, "Dear Mr. Okrent, that disgusting newspaper of yours did it again, slandering so-and-so who is an innocent person, and you just did it because of the bias and hatred that you've always shown for such-and-such, and your reporters are liars, and you made up the quote. Yours sincerely, whomever." And I write back and I say, "Well, you know, you're wrong. Here's what happened, and I disagree with you, but thank you for writing." And they write back and say, "Oh, this changes my opinion of the New York Times so much that you took the time to read what I wrote to you, to listen to what I had to say, and to answer it seriously. That means a great deal, and it means that I trust you. I trust your newspaper more."
What, in your opinion, was your most important column?
That's really tough. I guess I would have to say it was the one where I confronted the issue. The headline was, "Is the New York Times a liberal newspaper?" And I probably did not do the paper as much service as I would have liked to with that column, because by the very headline and the first line, which was, "Of course it is," I handed the paper's enemies something that could be taken radically out of context. I made it too quotable. I believe that, as I wrote at great length in that column, that the Times is, on certain issues, social issues, a liberal newspaper as a result of the place that it is published from and the nature of the people, the backgrounds of the people who work at the Times. It's not because somebody is sitting upstairs and saying, "Let's make this a liberal newspaper." It is a product of its place and of its people. And I think it's really important for the paper to recognize that and recognize how it is perceived as a result of that.
Thanks.
You're very welcome.
Daniel Okrent's last column as public editor will appear on May 22nd. He'll be succeeded in the post by Byron Kalame, who recently retired as a top editor at the Wall Street Journal. Kalame has agreed to stay 2 years.
When On the Media last covered what then Secretary of State Colin Powell called genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan, some 50,000 people were dead. It's now a mere 7 months later, and the death toll by some estimates is close to 400,000. So where is the television coverage? It's on a channel you don't get and have probably never seen, MTVU, which is broadcast exclusively to college campuses around the country. Joining me is Stephen Friedman, general manager of MTVU, and Nate Wright, a junior at Georgetown University, who traveled to Africa last month as a student correspondent for an MTVU documentary about Darfur. Stephen and Nate, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Stephen, I'm going to begin with you. Earlier this month in the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof said about Darfur, quote, MTV is raising the issue more openly and powerfully than our White House. And he added that the MTVU channel is covering Darfur more aggressively than most TV networks. Now, aside from that being a pretty stinging indictment of our own government and our press, is it also an indication of just American apathy overall? When you decided to cover this issue, weren't you concerned that students wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about, you know, much less any passion for the subject?
You know, I wasn't concerned, and we weren't concerned about the passion. We knew the passion would be there. We did know that there was not a huge level of understanding. We've seen kind of time and time again, college students are really the engine of social change. And you give them the information, and more importantly, you give them clear ways to get involved, and they take action.
Nate, you co-founded a group at Georgetown called STAND, Students Taking Action Now Darfur. And I guess by definition, you're an activist and were of a mind to do what you could. But how would you characterize other students' comprehension of the issue before STAND did its consciousness raising?
It was kind of surprising how little people understood about what was going on inside of Darfur. Take, for instance, the Arab versus African model. It does do a lot to describe the situation, but at the same point in time, you know, everyone inside of Darfur is both Arab and African. You know, to simply say that the sole motivator behind this conflict is itself ethnic really doesn't take into consideration all of the other things that are going on inside of Darfur.
Well, let's take a listen to this moment when you ask a man from Darfur who, as you spoke to him, was in a refugee camp in Chad, the simple question, why? Why were these armed militias killing his countrymen?
They take all what we have.
Do you know why they came after your village?
I don't know why. I don't know why. But we are surviving.
Yeah.
Still our life going on.
Right now, the voice of the people in Sudan has really been silenced, and it's been silenced by the distance, it's been silenced by disinterest, and really by the excuses that people put forward to not getting involved. If the people could speak, they would tell us essentially the stories of what's going on, of the witnesses themselves. You know, babies, when they're burning down the villages, are often thrown onto the fires. In the camps, for the women who remain inside of Darfur, every day they have to choose between starving by staying in the camps or being raped by going out to get firewood. And so when you look at a conflict like this, when you look at a genocide, there are always, you know, those who perpetuate the crimes themselves, and then there are also those who remain indifferent. And both of those are ways of perpetuating this tragedy. And so I think if there's one thing that I took away from it, it is the need to try and remove the indifference and to provide a consequence for those people who remain indifferent when there are tragedies like this in the world.
Stephen, I want to ask you about indifference. MTVU could probably just as well be named MTV Not You, because the experiences of refugees in Chad have so little to do with the lives of American college students. Are stories like this so repellent that the MTVU audience simply pushes them away?
You know, it's a good question. I think it's something we struggle with and struggled with as we were trying to figure out how to cover this. I mean, we did a number of public service announcements and featured a young man who had been enslaved for 10 years by the Janjaweed and escaped as one of the Lost Boys. We started it with telling the stories from the Darfurian refugees themselves. But when we did this documentary, we realized that it was going to be really important to send college students from the U.S. who our audience back home could identify with. And I think you experience through the eyes of Nate and Andrew and Stephanie, who is a student at Swarthmore, but in fact is originally from Rwanda. Her family escaped before the genocide. And I think through their eyes, we've seen a response from the audience where there's an entrance in that they can identify, not necessarily with what you're talking about the really devastation that these people are experiencing, but they can identify with the students and what students are doing.
Sometimes journalism occurs and has actually a very small original audience, but nonetheless has an effect. Is there any evidence that there have been any political repercussions of your Darfur documentary?
I think, you know, you can look at Harvard University, and they've just asked their administration to divest of any companies with a connection to the Sudanese government. And we hear from students at USC and a number of other campuses that that sort of divestment action, similar to what happened with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa in the early 90s, that is happening. So what is the impact? I'm not sure. I think little by little, students are pushing and realizing they can pressure their administration and maybe their government to do more.
Good for MTVU for sponsoring and running this documentary. Good for MTV and Viacom for engaging in some serious journalism. I'm going to guess it wasn't a huge ratings grabber. Will there be a follow-up?
Absolutely. And this, I should say, the documentary was just the latest piece. We've been doing programming on the crisis in Sudan throughout the year, and we're committed to this. I think we, as MTVU, as a college network, have the luxury. One, Nielsen rates us once a year, so we are rated differently, and that's a blissful thing. And I think working with college students, I think you can engage in topics more deeply, topics like this that are much more nuanced. So, yes, we are committed to continuing this, and you'll see more programming from us on this topic.
Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Stephen Friedman is general manager of MTVU, and Nate Wright is a student at Georgetown University and co-founder of STAND, Students Taking Action Now, Darfur.
You don't need to tell me that it could happen for me to care, you know? Genocide shouldn't have to be explained why you should take action. It shouldn't have to be explained why people should care. It should be a given. It's time for you to get off your ass and do something about it.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Rob Christensen, Susanna Dillaplane, and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.